This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. We have had an outstanding year here at WYLL, and it has been a year filled with award-winning news coverage and public affairs. And you know that if you listen regularly to Morning Edition or Afternoon Magazine. And certainly our local and regional staff have won awards for the reporting that they have done. And all of that has been made possible by the financial support of you, folks like you, who are part of this group of supporters we call the Friends of WYLL. Now, we want to say thank you very much for all of your support this year, and also remind you that there is still time for you to make a gift to support next year's news on this station. In fact, your contribution, if you do that before the end of the month, will help keep the news and information flowing here on WILL. You can do it one of two ways. You can call 217-244-9455, or you may contribute online at willpledge.org. Whichever way you do it, we thank you very much. Well, this morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about current politics in Europe. Proponents of the unification of Europe long argued that closer ties across national borders would do two things. They would lead to greater peace, and they would also lead to prosperity. I think a lot of people would say that certainly that first part, the peace, has been achieved, but there may be some big questions about the second part. This morning in this hour, we'll talk about the ongoing economic crisis in the EU, and our guest is John McCormick. He is professor of European Union politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. We'll talk a little bit about where things stand, what it means for the future of Europe, and try to connect it to our experience here in the United States. Of course, as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. No matter where you're listening, you can use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. If you would like, you can also send us an email, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor McCormick, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, what I didn't mention is that you have a professorship that is named for a man, Jean Monnet, who is considered, generally speaking, to be the father of European unity. So appropriate that we should be talking about this with you and at this time. And as a way to start, I'm interested in having you talk about where things stand now with the whole project of European unity. Is it threatened?
Well, you're actually talking to one of the last remaining optimistic analysts of the European Union. And the double odd thing is that I'm originally British as well, and there's very few people in Britain that like the European Union these days. I continue to be optimistic. It's been very difficult over the last 2 or 3 years. The news just gets worse and worse every day. But I think we have to look at the big picture. The euro is in deep trouble. This is the biggest crisis that the European Union has ever faced, and it's faced multiple crises since its creation. But I think we need to look beyond the euro and look at many of the other achievements that the European project has brought. I mean, you mentioned peace, which, of course, now 60-some years after the end of World War II doesn't ring quite as true with the younger generation. But it's not just peace after World War II. It's also Europe as a model of international organization and peace and democracy and free market. The single market project, which is one of the biggest projects the European Union has ever dealt with, continues to function extremely well. If there are any complaints about that, in fact, that it's not gone far enough, and there are a lot of people who would like to see more projects under the European single market. Now, the euro, yes, is an enormous bump in the road, but I think we will get past this. If you ask me why, I think simply, you know, to borrow the title of the book and the documentary, it's too big to fail. Mm. There's just too much to be lost by too many people to allow the euro to fail. And I know that's a little bit of a fluffy kind of answer, but I think at the end of the day, politicians with their backs to the wall will realize that the eurozone has to be saved and will do what it takes to save it.
Well, in the short term here, what people are watching is they're watching Greece. And there will be an election in Greece. And the Greeks, what they decide, it looks like it certainly will be very significant either way for Europe, as they are essentially deciding between people who are arguing that they should go with the bailout that has been offered and accept the austerity that's demanded. That's on one side. On the other side, people who are very angry about the austerity plan that they're being forced to accept. And if that side should prevail, it seems likely that they might well leave the eurozone or will abandon the euro. Given that Greece is actually a pretty small part of the EU's GDP, it's only a couple of percent, why does Greece matter so much? Why does its, whether it stays or goes, why does that matter so much?
Well, I think the key word here is contagion. If this domino falls, then maybe other dominoes will fall after that. But the thing that I find interesting about the analysis on Greece is that nobody really knows for sure what's going to happen. The whole euro as a project is uncharted territory to begin with, because you've never had 17 sovereign states with a long history of monetary and political independence voluntarily get together and combine and develop this single currency. And now we have this situation where on Sunday, if there is a clear winner, and that's still a big if, we could have the sight of well, depending on who wins, if Greece leaves the euro, there are multiple different scenarios as to what could happen, ranging from it's not really going to make very much difference to us, to a throwback to 2008 and the breaking of the global financial crisis. Some people have said this could be the worst crisis since World War II. Some people have said we could go back to the 1930s. So you have a whole range of possible scenarios. And essentially, I don't think anybody really knows. We're going to have to wait and see. And I think there is a tendency in the news business to lead with the most dramatic. They're going to say, you know, there's all kinds of terrible potential possibilities here, because that's newsworthy. But if you say, well, Greece has had its election and everybody's going to be happy from now on, it's really not very newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure on behalf of the news business, I'll cop to that. Absolutely, we do that. And I'm very struck by and interested in the way that you have answered the question about the potential here, because as you say, in much of the coverage that I have read, it seems almost there seems to be a certain inevitability that Greece will end up leaving the eurozone. And so you're saying, well, we really don't know what's going to happen.
No, I mean, an interesting thing about Greek politics is that they don't allow opinion polls for 2 weeks leading up to the election. So nobody has been able to measure public opinion for the last 2 weeks. But according to the opinion polls leading up to that cutoff point, plus the word on the street, it seems like the New Democracy Party, or coalition at least, could actually win on Sunday. Now, this is the pro-austerity, pro-bailout coalition, which was in power for a long time up until it lost a dramatic share of its seats last month. So if New Democracy and its is able to build a coalition, then this is a government that's going to be pro-austerity, pro-bailout. So that scenario would not lead us to Greece leaving. But if the anti-bailout, anti-austerity party is able to build a coalition and win on Sunday, then, of course, it's going to be quite different. But, you know, quite often political parties and political leaders will make all kinds of threats about what they're going to do and they're not going to do. And we all know that the reality of government is often quite different from all the promises that you make. So even the ones that are making threats, I wonder if, you know, if they're faced with the reality on Monday, okay, we won the election. Now, are we really going to pull Greece out of the euro? Let's think about all of the potential problems this is going to create for us. Would it not be better for us just to bite the bullet and try and deal with these problems and take that route instead? So, again, I remain optimistic.
Let me introduce our guest once again for anybody who might just have tuned in. John McCormick is a professor of European Union politics in the Department of Political Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And we are talking about the current economic crisis in the European Union in the EU. He's someone who follows EU politics and also British politics, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you mentioned, the British were never terribly high on the whole project, held themselves back from participating in the euro. I suppose there are people now today in Britain who would say, see, we made the right decision. Would it have, though, made very, would Britain's participation, more active participation, made very much difference?
Not really. I think the reason why we got to the difficulties that we are today is because there were design flaws in the euro, and the fundamental one was that there wasn't enough control given to the European Central Bank over fiscal policy, dealing with things like borrowing and taxes and spending and so forth. And then the second problem, there are three problems. The second one was that Greece should never have been allowed in the first place. That was a tactical error to allow Greece in. The reason for that is the third point, is that there were these rules, they were called the convergence criteria, where countries had to meet certain rules before they could join the euro. For example, their borrowing and their deficits and their inflation rates had to be below certain levels. And Greece didn't meet those requirements, so it shouldn't have been let in. And then even the countries that did get in, Germany being a prime leader, broke its own rule on fiscal responsibility. So if Britain had got into the euro, it wouldn't have made any difference because of those fundamental design problems to start with.
Mm. Well, that suggests that, and certainly we are used to now hearing complaints from the Germans in particular, but from the nations that are the more affluent about their having to bail out the nations that are in trouble. Was there something right from the get-go that said maybe a project like this that would bring together an economy as powerful as Germany and put that together with an economy that certainly had its issues like Greece or perhaps and some number of other countries you might name, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, does it really make sense?
Yes, one of the concerns about the euro from the beginning was that different countries are on different economic cycles, and if they have their own currencies, then they have much more freedom and independence to be able to deal with those different economic cycles. Now, if you bring these multiple countries in, each coming from a different economic base, then it makes it more difficult to deal with problems in part of this larger monetary union. I think that they're still going to, that they need to fix the design of the euro. They never quite knew what the effects of this all were going to be. Even today, they still don't know entirely what to do. There's lots of speculation about a banking union, about the issue of euro bonds and so forth. To a large extent, they're making this up as they go along, and they're trying to give the impression that they really are much more in control and know much more about what they're doing. But frankly, I don't think they do. Hmm. So I think we have to allow, to a certain extent, for the fact that this is really very much uncharted territory.
I have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is here where we are in Champaign County, and line number one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned that the Greek situation wasn't such that they should have gotten in. I always like to remind people that it was Goldman Sachs through some derivative, I think they were like interest rate swaps, helped them obscure the reality of their situation and let this. I think it was actually not the Papandreou government; it was the right wing one that did that. But So it brings up this whole idea of the derivatives. Somebody assured me, an economist assured me, that since they're counterparties to all of these, that it isn't like a situation where the bets are such that they would totally destabilize what's left of the economy. But since they're not transparent, we don't really know that. But the other thing that really prompted me to call was, and I haven't listened to my share of chat shows this morning and the news, but I did hear just an item that some stock markets in Europe rallied because the UK has actually announced a stimulus package. Now, you mentioned how the UK is out of the European Union, but these, you know, it just seems to me that the fact that even the UK has admitted that, you know, that growth and stimulus has to go ahead, you can't be entirely sadomonetarist, might actually affect the discourse in so I wanted you to just verify that, and then also mention if you thought that had any influence. Thanks.
Okay.
I guess I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, one point I'd make is the UK is in the European Union. It's just not in the Eurozone. I think one thing we have to make a distinction about is how much of the problems of the Eurozone are intrinsic to the Eurozone and how much has been a consequence of this unfortunate global financial crisis that came first, and then the Eurozone crisis came later. I'm not an economist and I'm not a business specialist, but one thing that I picked up over the years is that the key word when it comes to the managing economies and businesses and financial markets and so forth is confidence. And if there's confidence in the situation, things will look better. If there's a lack of confidence, things will look worse. The problem is quite often you can't really quantify what constitutes confidence or a lack of confidence. Often it's just a feeling, very, very unscientific indeed. And this is why I'm sort of puzzled by all of these different scenarios that people come up with, ranging from okay, everything's going to be okay for a while, or okay over the long term, to this is going to be just disastrous. Again, it's going to be very interesting. I'm actually flying to Spain on Sunday, and I'm wondering if, I just joke to myself, is the euro going to exist by the time I land on Sunday evening? Of course it will, but Sunday is going to be very interesting. And depending on the outcome of the Greek election, it's going to change the nature of confidence, either more confidence or less confidence, and then we just sort of take it from there.
Mm. Well, again, people who are listening, you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just this past weekend, there was a deal reached that would lend up to 100 billion euro to Spain to shore up its banks. It's the fourth big bailout that's happened in the last 2 years, although I think that some people have looked at the amount of money that's been set aside for that kind of purpose and said it's nowhere near. You know, we're not going to have to talk about billions of euros. We're going to have to talk about trillions of euros and to really have a big enough pot of money to help out those institutions that might need it.
The interesting thing about Spain, as I understand it, is that most of Spain's problems are not really tied directly to the euro, because I mentioned that several of these countries, like Germany, had misbehaved on the rules regarding fiscal behavior. Spain is actually one of those countries that actually worked by the rules. And so theoretically, Spain should actually have come out of this quite well. But from what I understand of the Spanish situation is it's largely an internal problem there. They had this housing bubble which burst. Their construction industry has collapsed. It's caused enormous unemployment problems. The unemployment rate, I believe, is about 23%. But among people under the age of 25, I think it was just on NPR News, it's close to half of the population under the age of 25 is unemployed. This actually worries me a lot more than all of this talk about the euro, because there's a real problem here that a whole generation is going to be emerging that knows almost nothing but austerity and maybe tempted to blame the euro for many of the problems that it sees around it. But we'll have to wait and see on that. And Spain is not the only country. Several other countries, Portugal and Italy, have had similar problems.
Another caller here. We have someone in Indiana. We'll talk with them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, just barely, but yes, we can.
Okay. I'm a big fan of the European Union as well, because as a terrorist, I love just having a single currency to deal with as opposed to a thousand different ones, as well as the idea. But But I wanted to know, I know this country is part of the European Union. How do you feel about you following Iceland as an example? We're basically just letting the banks go bankrupt and sort of retaining solvency for the country.
What, is the question clear, Professor McCormick?
It is, but it's not. Unfortunately, it's not my area.
Ah.
I can't really comment in any sense on the sort of the economic the way that Iceland pursued its banking situation. So I'll have to pass on that one.
Okay. Well, I would just like to say, how did you feel giving Greece a bailout? You know, initially I thought that was a terrible idea. Greece default on their loans.
I'm afraid that the callers are really breaking up on us. I guess I take the question as being something like, and again, this may be a question for an economist, but one might ask, well, what's the purpose of bailing out anybody? Should you just let, if they make bad decisions, if a bank makes a bad decision, well, why not just let that bank and its shareholders have to live with the consequences? And if they're going to fail, we just let them fail.
Well, we've had that conversation in this country as well, haven't we? I mean, should we have bailed out all of these big corporations and these banks and some of these financial firms that in many ways were implicated in creating many of these problems in the first place? My answer would be, well, again, if you let some of these places fail, I mean, if you let General Motors fail, the implications of this are enormous, and they'll run right throughout the economy. And, of course, we can sit down here 3 years later and say, well, bailing out GM was a terrible idea, but if we hadn't bailed out GM, I wonder if we would be quite so sanguine about the whole thing now, in retrospect.
Our guest in this hour of focus is John McCormick. He's a political scientist. His particular interest is the European Union and European politics. He's joining us by telephone here. He teaches at the Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and we're pleased to have him. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As I read about this and read not just about the economic aspects but the political aspects, it interests me that people are talking about the fact that while the what we're talking about here is an economic union, at least in the sense that the countries have agreed to use a common currency, it's not a political union. And each country makes its own decisions about things like taxes and spending, and that's maybe helps to explain the problem that they're in now. Because every country is making its own decisions about things like taxes and spending. What would a real political union, let's set aside whether or not it could happen or whether it can happen now, what would a real political union in Europe look like?
Well, that's a very good question. One of the difficulties I have when talking to folks about the European Union is just explaining the fundamental question or answering the question of what is it?
Mm-hmm.
There is no answer to that question, unfortunately, because really the answer depends on who you ask. It's much more than a standard international organization along the lines of the United Nations, because it involves far more commitment. It's got treaties, it's got its own body of law, it's got common policies and so forth. And yet it's not a United States of Europe along the lines of the United States of America, a federal arrangement. There are some people who would like it to be that. And that was one of the key goals of people like Jean Monnet right at the beginning, was they wanted a United States of Europe at the end, but they thought it would take a while to get there. My answer is that it's a confederal system. I don't really quite understand why the use of the word confederation is not more popular in terms of explaining the European Union, because if you look at its dynamics, it actually fits almost perfectly the model of a confederal system, which is a union of states where you have sovereign states that come together in areas where it makes sense for them to come together, and they don't build another level of government. They just have institutions that help them coordinate and work together on law and policy and so forth, but they're still sovereign. And we've had several examples in history of confederations. Obviously, the United States very briefly was a confederation, but one of the jokes about confederations is that they either fail completely or they become federations, and that's why we see very few confederations in history that last a long time. But I think for now it's a confederal system, and that means that there's a mix of fundamentally all power lies still with the member states. And people who talk about the European institutions as having too much power don't really understand the way they work, because most of these European institutions, their members are in fact representatives of the member states, so they're simply getting together and working on matters of mutual interest. Now, if you understand it as a confederal system, then a lot of the rest of it, I think, makes sense. And they have a shopping list of things where they said, we need to cooperate, the single market, for example. And in other areas, like tax policy, they said, we don't need to cooperate, or we don't want a common European army, for example. Now, one of the things about the single market is that it inevitably led to the single currency, because the argument was that you couldn't really have a functioning single market without a single currency. And that's where they've obviously got themselves into trouble now.
We're talking this morning with John McCormick from Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis campus. He's interested in European politics. We're talking about the EU and the current economic crisis there. We have another caller we'll get to in just a moment. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Henry Hill, the former mobster portrayed by Ray Liotta in the film Goodfellas, died Tuesday. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to an interview with Nick Pileggi, who wrote the book about Hill's life, Wise Guy, which he adapted into the movie Goodfellas. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday's tasting features a sampling of rosés, followed from 7 to 9 by the mellow jazz music of Ken Smith.
This is Focus, our morning talk show here on WILL. We're here Monday through Friday, 10 to noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Let me just mention two for next week. On Monday, we'll start off with our regular monthly show on home maintenance. So if you have a question, something needs to be fixed, you can talk with Scott Spies. He works as a home inspector. Then on Tuesday at 10 o'clock, our guest will be Scott Wallace. He's a journalist and photographer, and we will talk about his book, The Unconquered, in search of the Amazon's last uncontacted tribes, which is a story, quite an extraordinary story, of a trip that he made into some of the deepest areas of the Amazon to try to make contact with one of the planet's last uncontacted indigenous tribes. It's quite the story. So that's what we have for you on Tuesday at 10. Other shows as well. You can find out what we'll do next week by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to many past programs as well. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with John McCormick. He is Jean Monnet Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And he's joining us this morning by phone. We're talking about what's going on currently in Europe. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some callers. Next person is in Decatur. We'll do Champagne first, then we'll do Decatur. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a question going back to Greece. So far, the two main possibilities that I hear being discussed is pro-austerity forces win in the next in the Sunday election, then Greece probably will stay in the eurozone, and if anti-austerity forces win, then it probably will leave. But it seems to me that there is a third scenario which is much more likely in the eventuality that anti-austerity forces will win, which is that Greece will default on its loans but stay within the euro. I mean, so could you talk a little bit more about this possibility and why isn't it being discussed more? Okay, thank you.
All right.
I'll listen off the air.
Very, very good. Thank you for the question. Professor McCormick, can you answer that question?
I think it has been discussed. The problem with defaulting on your debt is that your credit rating just falls through the floor. So any possibilities that Greece would be able to get any further assistance from other European Union countries or ECB member states and so forth would be fundamentally compromised, I'm putting it politely there. I think Greece has to maintain its credibility as a sovereign state. So if it stays on with the pro-austerity, pro-bailout policy, then it seems to be playing by the rules, to the extent that the rules exist. If it goes for the anti-austerity, anti-bailout philosophy and decides to leave the euro, then that is an option which is available to it, and it could be justified as a rational way of dealing with this problem. But if it simply defaults and says, well, we don't care, we have a problem but we don't care, I think the political and ramifications of that would just be too serious for Greece's future relationship with its European Union partners.
All right, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We will go on and talk with someone in Decatur. This is our line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to have the guest comment on the Bilderberg Group and their heavy, heavy influence towards united Europe, both politically and economically. Most of the Bilderbergers are heads of IMF, Trichet, and so on and so forth. So I think Angela Merkel is also a Bilderberger. So I'd like to hear your comment on their heavy influence on keeping things together. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Can you do that?
I'm not sure about the influence. I can't really comment on that, but I don't know if the caller would want me to talk about the potential for a united Europe.
Well, go ahead and do that, because I think I'm not an economist, so maybe I tend to look at things a little bit more like a political scientist might. And to me, that the potential for that is, it seems that that's the big question. Could that happen? How would it happen? At what point might it happen? And what would it look like?
Well, if you look at federal systems, for example, around the world, and there are roughly 20, depending on how you define a federal system, what you quickly realize is that all of them look actually quite different in their own way. There's no template for a federal system as such. So the United States is fundamentally different in some ways from, say, Germany or Switzerland or other places like that. So to talk about, I mean, the possibility of European Union is there, but what exactly it means, it just could be another variation on the theme of a federal system, which could be looser, perhaps, than the United States, with more power retained in the hands of its member states, which I know a lot of people in this country would like to see that happen in this country, the federal government having accumulated too much power over time, they would argue. So you can have a looser form of federation, which would then be a United States of Europe. And many people would argue that Europe is very close to that point now, even though it's still, as I said earlier, still fundamentally a confederal system. There are a lot of people in Europe who would like to see a United States of Europe. And I think over time the number is growing. It's growing very, very slowly, because, once again, nobody quite knows what it would involve and how much power it would involve shifting, and what kind of agreements would have to be made among the member states itself. But it's definitely possible, and as I said earlier, it's always been one of the goals, or always one of the fundamental goals of the people who formulated the European Union in the first place. Mm.
It seems, though, to me that there are many, many loud voices who talk about national sovereignty and talk about not wanting to cede anything to somebody else in some other country, and not let somebody else someplace else dictate what we fill in the blank here in our country, what our policy is. Isn't that not always going to be a problem?
That's true, and we have this phenomenon called Euroscepticism, which is being talked a lot about and studied a lot. But the thing about Euroscepticism is it is not an amorphous movement. There are multiple different shades of Euroscepticism. So within it, you will find people who are totally opposed to the European Union and European integration and would like to get their country out as quickly as possible. That's one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got people who think, well, the European Union is a good idea. We just don't like some of the fundamentals, and we'd like some reform. So there are all these different possibilities that are out there. But the concept of European Union is so amorphous and so difficult to really pin down that it can almost be whatever you want it to be, which really complicates the conversations, unfortunately.
Mm. There's something else I'd like to have you talk about. It seems to be that in terms of European politics here, and I mean politics within particular nations, that the kind of dislocation, economic dislocation that people are experiencing, that this reality that you talked about earlier, where you have people who maybe have known nothing but austerity, for whom the future looks pretty bleak, there are a lot of angry people, and they particularly don't like the idea of somebody from some other country imposing austerity on them. And this apparently has been very good for the extremes in European politics, both on both ends of the spectrum, at the expense of the middle. And certainly it's been seen in Greece and other places. What can you talk about that, that is this disaffection as a force in politics, and what that means generally for politics in Europe?
No, it's a very worrying part of what is happening in Europe at the moment. But my sense is that with, say, right-wing anti-immigrant political parties, which really haven't, I mean, some countries they've had more effect than others. So, for example, in Austria, they actually became part of the governing coalition briefly. It's very easy, I think, for them to point the finger of blame at things that would ring a bell with their potential supporters. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the blame they're apportioning is, in fact, correct. They would blame immigrants, and frankly, what we're talking about here is not white immigrants. We're not talking about the ubiquitous Polish plumber going from Poland to France. We're talking about non-white immigrants and Muslim immigrants. That's what they are really pointing their finger at. And they're using, I think they're using scapegoats to try and explain some of the social problems that these countries are having. Now, whether those are in fact the sources of their problems is an entirely debatable point. There is a danger that yes, these problems will feed into this kind of backlash. But, you know, in the case of Spain, I wonder if Spain had not even been part of the European Union or part of the Eurozone, I suspect it would probably still have the same kind of problems it's having now, because it made a number of unfortunate domestic economic policy choices. You know, up until 2 or 3 years ago, Spain was doing extremely well, but apparently its economic growth was built on very weak foundations. So the argument that perhaps Spanish people on the left and people on the right are pointing accusatory fingers at the euro or the European Union, it doesn't necessarily follow that in fact the euro or the European Union are the source of their problems, rather than domestic issues. And I think that's probably also the case with Greece. I mean, Greece has had a long history of having a black market where people don't pay their taxes or don't report their income accurately. And now the government has been doing the same thing, which is just bizarre to think about. Now, whose fault is it, really? The Greeks have a situation now where they have to live in austerity. Whose fault is it? One of the potential sources of the problem is the Greeks themselves. So the argument that they can point the finger at the euro and at the Germans and so forth, and is that entirely fair and accurate?
Well, does if there are, I don't know if I'm making too much of this, but if there are places where there, you know, here in the United States, we talk about the further spread between left and right and how there's not, we don't see quite so much middle ground as we used to, and that makes it a little difficult to govern if both sides say there's no possibility of compromise. Are there places in Europe where it has come to that point?
Where
politics has become so polarized that it's difficult to come to grips with real issues because people don't want to compromise.
Not really, because the parliamentary system is built on the idea that you have political parties that have to have majorities, or if they don't have majorities, they have to build coalitions. So European political culture is more focused on coalitions and on consensus. Of course, you'll always have parties of the left and parties of the right who are different. So, for example, in Britain, you've got this party called the United Kingdom Independence Party, which people look at and say this is an example of how anti-European feeling in Britain has actually produced this new political party. But in fact, UKIP, the only real damage it's going to be able to sustain at an election is taking seats away from the other two big parties. It's not going to win seats itself, because it's won very, very few seats at the local or the European level. But what it can do is cause problems for the other parties. But UKIP likes to point the finger of blame at Europe for almost all of Britain's problems. But it doesn't. Its existence doesn't mean that British politics has become polarized. And in fact, you know, Britain right now, for the first time in 70, 80 years, has a coalition government, which suggests that, on the contrary, it's not polarized, but it's actually the 2.5 major parties are sort of swilling around there in the middle of the political field. And the marginal parties are really not playing very much of a role in national politics.
Mm. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 6 or 7 minutes left in this hour of focus. I'd just like to introduce again the guest, if you have just tuned in. We are talking this morning with John McCormick. He is the Jean Monnet Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And his particular area of interest is the European Union and comparative politics and British politics, and we're talking about what's going on now in politics in Europe, and questions are certainly welcome. Someone wants to get in here. We have time for a couple. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email is also possible. will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the questions that I wanted to put to you was this question. For people here in the United States, this all seems to be rather remote, and when we talk about the EU and how it functions, it can get pretty arcane pretty quickly. And I think that there might be many people here who would wonder, well, what's this really got to do with us?
No, that's a very good point, but I think it's not just the United States, it's almost everywhere. People, you know, the further away something is from your daily life, the less role it plays in your life. So, you know, the Europeans are just have exactly the same thought process as Americans. Interestingly, however, I think that for the first time in an awful long time, what's happening in Europe could have a direct and immediate impact on the outcome of the election in November. And the Obama administration realizes this and is being directly and indirectly cajoling the Europeans to get their house in order. Because if there is a Eurozone meltdown between now and November, it's going to inevitably spill over into the United States simply because of the way the international financial markets are set up and the way the international trading system is set up. And if there is a Euro meltdown, then my prediction is that Obama is going to lose in November. If, however, the Europeans are able to at least keep their heads above water between now and November, then my prediction is that Obama will win in November. Now, what that means, it is arcane, and it's awfully complicated. And even economists don't understand what's going on, so how can, you know, humble political scientists explain the whole thing? But, the way the international system is set up with globalization and financial markets and so forth, the fact that the European Union is such a huge market, a trade market, an investment market for the United States, if the Eurozone, even the 17 countries within the 27th European Union, has this problem, then it's going to have a direct and immediate impact on the U.S. economy. And our rather slow recovery over the last few years is going to really be seriously undermined, I think.
Mm. We have another caller here. We'd certainly get this person in and the time that remains. We have a couple. We'll try to get them both. First in line is Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hi. Was it in Argentina who defaulted 3-5 years ago, and I don't remember them undergoing such protracted convulsions. What's the difference between them and Greece? I'll hang up. Thank you.
Is that a question that you can answer? I'm not sure that this is your area, but go ahead.
I'll speculate. My sense is that, I mean, when Mexico was about to default back in 1995, the United States and 50-some other countries very quickly stepped up to help Mexico get past its problems, and Mexico paid back its debt. My suspicion is that Argentina is not as much of an economic actor in the world and is not as much tied into the U.S. or the European economy as Mexico was, but that's just my semi-educated assumption.
All right, we'll go to another caller here. This is line two in Ed Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I didn't catch the old program, so my apologies if I repeat anything. You obviously know who Paul Krugman is, and he's pointed out repeatedly that really, from his perspective at least as an economist, that the problem was with Germany, that Greece is an outlier in a sense because it had tremendous problems. But Spain, as you pointed out, was historically really not a problem except for the crisis that we're in currently. And so he says we're in a depression, and therefore the problem is Merkel. As long as she tries to treat the European Union as not a union and tries to force austerity on a series of other states, that will continue to produce a crisis and, well, how should I say, prolong what he calls essentially a depression.
I know that's entirely conceivable, but it's interestingly, I mean, I think Merkel's looking to a domestic electorate, obviously. Germans have worked very hard over the last 60 years to rebuild their country, and they've done it through clever and sensible economic policies on the whole. And I think they look at Greece and they say, well, why should we now have to pay the burden or bear the cost, pay the cost, bear the burden of helping the Greeks bail out when they haven't been behaving themselves over time? Now, there's another economist, well, he's a financier, George Soros, who made a speech earlier this month in which he put a much more positive spin on the euro. He did say that they've got about 3 months to save the euro. Okay, that's not very positive. But he also said he believes the euro is here to stay and that it will survive and that Angela Merkel is absolutely the lead player in this, but she will come around and she will support the concept of the banking union and euro bonds. We'll have to wait to the end of this month. There's a summit on June 28th, 29th, at which many of these conversations will be had, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that Angela Merkel, who's really been changing her position slowly over time, would undergo some substantial change of philosophy and direction as a result of this summit, which I think could lead to a full economic union in the Eurozone, at least.
Yeah, I know that the European Central Bank last week or 2 weeks ago refused to decrease interest rates. And so, you know, the economists and others were aghast. You know, you essentially have depressed economies. They're deflating, and they won't lower interest rates, which is just inconceivable in economic terms. And, you know, Merkel, of course, has been a prime influence there. And hopefully she will come around before it's too late because they're in a dire situation, in my view at least, and certainly Krugman and others feel this way. Hopefully they can let go of Greece somehow. Greece is a real problem, but the rest of them, they can probably save if they're really willing to stimulate these economies. But I wouldn't bank on it with the German populace. I don't know. But anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, we're coming down to, we just have a couple of minutes left. Just to come back for a moment to the president, to President Obama, here coming up at the beginning, I believe the beginning of next week in Mexico, we're going to have a big economic summit. This is the G20. And I think a lot of people expect that Europe and its problems will be issue number one. And in as much as you've talked about how you think that Mr. Obama's re-election potential will have a lot to do with how things are doing in Europe, you know, having said that, it also doesn't look as if he really is in a position to do much. That is, is there anything, do you think, that the United States really can do to assist the countries in Europe in dealing with their problems?
It would be in the form of advice and encouragement rather than a new Marshall Plan or anything like that. You know, I'm sure that he can sit down with Angela Merkel and François Hollande and others and say, look, we're all in this together. You guys have got to concentrate and focus here. We've had lots of different possibilities about how we get out of this crisis. It is a deep crisis, and we don't want it to get worse because it's going to impact all of us. So I'm sure that it's just really advice is what he's going to be passing on and has been passing on. The question is whether they will take this advice or not.
Well, here's a way of finishing up. I guess I find myself going back to the very first thing that you said when I asked you this very general question about the future, and you said you felt that, in a sense, you were in kind of a minority because you were one of the few people that was optimistic about the future of Europe. Do you think, given time, and it could be some time, that that we might actually see something of a, I hesitate to use the term, but something of a United States of Europe?
Yes, I think so. I don't know when it'll happen. I think it'll be more of a confederal system than a federal system. I do remain optimistic because I think we don't have time now to to talk about this, but very briefly, I just say I'm actually writing a book now called Why Europe Matters, and I'm trying to convince people, remind people of all the great things that Europe has achieved for Europeans and for the rest of the world. It's going to be a tough sell for sure, but I think we're going to get past this euro problem. At some point, we're going to look back on it and laugh a little bit. That's my sense. And at that point, we're going to have moved so far past it and have moved back into things like the single market and building common foreign policies and continuing the common trade policy. This will just be a very unfortunate memory, but something that I think people will have learned an awful lot from. And then one final thing is I think the silver lining is that where people did not pay very much attention to the European Union or the euro before, now everybody's paying very, very close attention. So it's actually a very good learning experience.
Well, there is a good point for us to stop, and stop we must, because we're here at the end of the time. Our thanks to John McCormick. He is a Jean Monnet Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Professor McCormick, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.